This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Beth Voorhees. Residents in the state's northern panhandle organized a protest outside Wheeling's municipal offices late last week. They want members of the city council to consider declaring Wheeling a sanctuary city. Sanctuary cities adopt policies to protect unauthorized immigrants by not prosecuting them for violating federal immigration laws. Word got around through social media about the event, and a counter-protest was also organized. This, despite public announcements from city officials that no plans of becoming a sanctuary city were in the works. More than 100 people still showed up with signs, flags, and thoughts they wanted to share. Glennis Board brings us some of the sounds of the events Friday.
I'm Marty Starkey. I'm just a resident of the area. Sanctuary cities are something that, that all of us at one time or another needed. Every person standing here was an immigrant at one time or another. Every person here went through prejudice at one time or another. So carrying it forward and saying we want to be more prejudiced than we have been in the past seems a little bit archaic to me, and it seems as if we are wanting to go backward. In fact, we are going backward to where we want to promote hate, we want to promote anger.
Yeah, I'm Joe White and living in Elm Grove. Even though the city manager and the city council said there's no way it'll ever be a sanctuary city ever, I thought we would just show a little show of force against these folks that want a sanctuary city. Police officer earlier said he thought we had close to 100. They might have 15 or 20 people.
I'm Judy Steinman from Wheeling, West Virginia. I'm holding a flag that says September the 11th, 2001. Well, my grandparents are immigrants from Croatia, and they came over when my grandfather was young. I don't know exactly how old, but they came through Ellis Island. They went through that process, then they were went sent somewhere else, and they went through another process. And finally, they were more or less free, and they settled in Washington, D.C. I don't care if you come here. Don't come here and get all the education and then turn around and kill us.
Okay.
Go home and fight your own battles. Go home and save your own country. Leave ours alone.
I'm Gwen Giffen. I'm from Bel Air, Ohio, and I'm a nurse. I believe that a sanctuary city would provide maybe a few hundred people of the millions who are fleeing for their lives with a place to live and would benefit the city and the people in it, both financially, economically, and spiritually.
And I called my cow, no milk now, and the land was sweet and good, and I did what I could.
The sounds of a sanctuary city protest in Wheeling, produced by Glennis Board. The Ohio Valley once helped give rise to the labor movement. Now the region is seeing a move toward right-to-work laws, which unions oppose. Proponents say the laws attract new businesses, but opponents say there's little evidence to support that. Becca Schimmel has a closer look.
Mike Mullis is a site selection consultant who has spent 25 years helping global corporations such as Toyota pick the places where they will build major projects. He says some companies, particularly in manufacturing, will perk up when they hear the words right to work. However, that doesn't mean businesses will come flocking to a state.
The thing that is misunderstood by many people is that right to work does not guarantee you projects. It simply guarantees you more opportunity.
He says other factors are more important, such as the skill of the workforce, infrastructure, and transportation. Mullis supports right to work, but he notes many oversimplify its connection to workplace growth. The Supreme Court ruled in the 1970s that an employee cannot be forced to join a union as a condition of employment. Right-to-work laws, which are decided on a state-by-state basis, often go a step further. They eliminate the requirement for non-union workers to pay what are called fair share fees. Unions strongly object to that, as we'll hear in a moment. But University of Kentucky economist Kenneth Trosky says such laws can help attract businesses.
That's essentially what the research shows, is that when plants become unionized, you see a decline in productivity.
Trosky says businesses like the promise of flexible workplace schedules and greater productivity.
It sends a signal to businesses that, hey, the state, you know, as a state, we are trying to make ourselves more open and friendly and as flexible as possible for businesses that want to locate here in an attempt to sort of basically attract those businesses and the jobs that come with them.
He says new businesses that locate in right-to-work states are competing for the same skilled workers, so even if wages lower, it would not be as dramatic as some opponents of the law say. Ross Eisenbray is vice president of the Economic Policy Institute, a nonprofit think tank focused on the needs of middle and low-income workers. He says right-to-work has never been shown to make a difference in employment growth. Eisenbray is skeptical of claims that right-to-work laws do much to attract new business.
Corporate CEOs who answer surveys about what are the factors that determine where they locate don't even have right-to-work in the top 10 factors that influence their decisions.
Eisenbray points to economic evidence showing that right-to-work laws come at a cost in the form of weaker unions and lower wages. In West Virginia, a group of unions is suing the state over its new right-to-work law. A judge put a stay on the law shortly after it was signed last year. Ken Hall is general secretary treasurer with the Teamsters, one of the unions involved in the lawsuit.
If this was good for workers, why is it that like 8 of the 10 states with the lowest per capita income are right-to-work states?
Hall says that right-to-work laws mean unions don't have the option of collecting money from non-members, but the unions are still responsible for collective bargaining for those employees and defending them in the event of grievances. Hall says that weakens unions and can hurt workers more than it helps a region generate new business.
That's part of the problem here, that it's been so much dishonesty. I mean, put the facts out there and then let the people decide.
The unions expect a decision on their challenge to West Virginia's law in a couple of weeks. Kentucky is just beginning to implement its new right-to-work law as Ohio is reviving its debate on the issue. The real effect of right-to-work in this region, once dominated by union labor, remains to be seen. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Becca Schimmel in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
The Ohio Valley Resource is made possible with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. This is West Virginia Morning. It's 7:51. Some very dense fog this morning, giving way to mostly sunny skies this afternoon. Temperatures in the 60s. Mostly clear overnight with lows in the 40s. Increasing cloudiness tomorrow with a chance of rain late in the day. Temperatures in the upper 50s and 60s. A chance of rain Wednesday morning, becoming partly cloudy later Wednesday with temperatures in the 60s to low 70s.
Support for this weather forecast is provided by Erie Insurance, putting service first since 1925. Local agents are available at erieinsurance.com. Support for West Virginia Public Broadcasting is provided by Covenant House, presenting the annual Chef's Challenge, this year with new Appalachian cuisine on Tuesday, March 14th at Charleston Civic Center, eradicating hunger and creating well-being in our community. More at wvcovenanthouse.org.
8 out of more than 900 water systems in West Virginia are intractable or abandoned, meaning that no one is responsible for treating the water or maintaining the system. All 8 are in the southern part of the state. 4 of them are in Wyoming County. In Garwood, West Virginia, the intractable water system draws its water from an abandoned mine. So what are the health risks of getting water from an abandoned mine? Reporter Ann Lee reached out to the experts and spoke with host Jessica Lilly on the latest episode of Inside Appalachia. Here's an excerpt from the show.
You know, I know there are lots of communities in southern West Virginia who get their drinking water from a mine source. What are the risks of drinking untreated water from an underground mine source?
So I've been working with the West Virginia Department of Health and Human Resources, as well as Paul Zemkevich, the director of the West Virginia Water Research Institute at West Virginia University, to figure out what the risks are with drinking untreated mine water. Zemkevich has spent a lot of time on water issues in southern West Virginia, and it just so happens that he's examined source drinking water from abandoned coal mines. And there are some chemicals in particular that indicate that mine drainage is present in the water. Zemkevich points out that some chemicals are more dangerous than others.
Well, in the southern part of the state, the sort of things I always look for are things like sulfate, for starters, iron, manganese, and all three of those are what are called secondary contaminants. In other words, they won't kill you. They won't make you even particularly sick at the concentrations we're looking at. But they will impart a nasty taste to the water. They will stain your sink and your toilets and your bathtub. So that's why they consider secondary contaminants. The primary contaminants are the ones that can hurt you. Selenium is another common tracer or marker for mine drainage. So those are the main ions that we look at. And you can pretty much tell by how the concentrations whether or not you've got a source that is severely degraded by typical acid mine drainage chemistries.
Acid mine drainage, by the way, is the acidic water that flows out from a mine.
We've heard from a family in Garwood, West Virginia, which currently gets its water from an abandoned mine. What do we know about the water in this system?
Well, we can't say what's in the water now because the DHHR says Garwood Community Water hasn't reported test results since 2014. But I did ask Zemkevich to take a look at the data we do have from 2000 to 2014. Now, keep in mind, Garwood never tested for iron and manganese, which are two secondary contaminants that Zemkevich looks for in particular in mine water. So with the limited data that we do have, Zemkevich actually says that the water in Garwood seems to be pretty good.
For example, trihalomethane, or THM, the numbers that I'm seeing here are less than 5 micrograms per liter. The Safe Drinking Water Act level is 80, so these numbers are well below that.
But there was one serious contaminant that came up between 2000 and 2014.
The only thing that was showing up was coliform, and that can come from either humans or animals, but generally, when you see coliforms, you wonder about sewage.
So fecal coliform is what happens when sewage or anything from an animal or human's gut gets into the water. And Zemkevich says it's common in communities that don't have the revenue base to support updated infrastructure. Now, the good news is the last time Garwood's water quality was reported in 2014, coliform wasn't detected.
At any rate, since 2008, there haven't been any coliform meetings at all. So whatever was done worked.
In any case, Zemkevich says it's never good to drink untreated water.
What you're telling me is that we don't know what's in the water right now, and we haven't known since 2014. And at one time back in 2007 and 2008, there were dangerous contaminants in the water. I can't help but to think of the children and the babies who need water for their bottles and things like that. How can families protect themselves from water that isn't being treated?
Yeah, so boiling your water is definitely the most important first step. The DHHR says the Garwood community has been on a boil water advisory since April of 2015. And Zemkevich says that boiling your water before you use it will kill off any coliforms. Now, you can also install filters in your plumbing that will prevent most chemical contaminants from reaching your tap. But boiling your water, although it does take time, is the cheapest option.
I hope we can continue to look into these systems across our region. Thanks so much, Anne, for your help.
No problem.
That was Inside Appalachia host Jessica Lilly speaking with reporter Ann Lee about the risks of drinking untreated water from an abandoned mine. You'll find this conversation and more on the latest Inside Appalachia podcast. It's available on iTunes, Downcast, WVPublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Keep up with all the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Ashton Mara. Our director this morning is Chuck Anzalevich. I'm Beth Voorhees.